from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I want you to pay attention tonight to the webcam for the show, and that's at www.com, and again, it's weird, but it's only two W's, www.com/DanaPretzer1. That's the show webcam, and for those of you watching on Access Channel 7 on television, I'm going to hold up this the book that I have in my hand here. And why? Well, we're going to give away a few of them tonight. The book is called Divorce Poison, How to Protect Your Family from Bad-Mouthing and Brainwashing. And it's by Dr. Richard A. Warshak. He's also the author of The Custody Revolution. And I'll hold that up for both the webcam and the television camera. This book has been out for a while. I think it's in its 20th printing, but it's revised with a new introduction and afterward. And I thought I'd bring on Dr. Warshak tonight to talk about this, talk about the book. We've seen high-profile cases like the Sean Goldman case, the boy from that was taken to Brazil, and many others. We've covered them here on the program many times, especially with divorces and parental abductions with one spouse heading to Japan and sad stories like that. And what better time to talk to Dr. Warshak than tonight? Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Thanks for inviting me, Dana.
Welcome to the program. And I do, like I say to the listeners, whether you're listening live or watching live, I do have a few copies of the book, and the easiest way for me to give them away is for you to email me, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, and the first few emailers to me will get a complimentary copy of the book. Dr. Warshak, welcome to the show. Let's talk about Divorce Poison. By error, and your publisher was kind enough to straighten me out, I said this is a new book. It's not a new book. It's a book that's been around for a while, but the message is still very current. Tell us about it.
That's right. Well, this particular issue, though, is a revised edition. It's a lot of new material. I've learned a lot in the last 8 years since the book was first released. But, you know, you mentioned parents who have abducted children, and this book is about that, but it's also about the much larger group of children where there's a psychological abduction. You mentioned the Goldman case. Both of those happened in the Goldman case. This boy was kept apart from his dad, but at the same time, as it looked like the dad might succeed in getting the boy back, then the boy was influenced to start speaking negatively about his father. They even issued a videotape of the boy basically saying that he felt violated by his father's visits. Not the kind of word you'd expect a young boy to use.
Exactly, and that was a story I covered here on the program many times, and again, many parental types of, in fact, we called them abductions in many cases, and you used the term brainwashing. Some used words, other words than that, but playing a child against one parent against the other, using the child as a bargaining chip, I guess, for lack of a better term, is something that's so common. And you wondered, Dr. Rorschach, if you cover that in your book, I'm sure. Do parents intentionally do this to say, your dad is this or your mom is this, and knowing very well the child will take that back to them?
There's a range of parents who do this. Some of them are really unaware of what they're doing. They're unaware both of what they're doing, that they're exposing their children to this. They're also unaware of how harmful it is to the children. But then there are other parents at the other end of the spectrum who know exactly what they're doing. A man tells his wife who leaves him that, I'm going to show you what it's like to not be loved by someone. You're not going to see your children again. And then he makes good on the threat by manipulating the children and getting them to think their mother's a horrible person. So in the book I give a example of a family where the mother would tell the children that your dad doesn't care enough about you to send airplane tickets so you can come, so you can visit him. And then when the children grow up, they find in the mother's drawer that she's been hiding the airplane tickets that dad's been sending all these years, deliberately making the children feel unloved by their father. Perhaps not focusing on how awful that must feel for the children, but clearly some of these parents just feel that the other parent is not worthy of being involved with the children or is too dangerous to be around the children, and basically that the kids just don't need the other parent.
Dr. Warshak's webpage is accessible by clicking on the link in the show notes, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And the book, again, is Divorce Poison, How to Protect Your Family from Badmouthing and Brainwashing. And we're going to give away a few copies of that book tonight. Just email me, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, and I'll send you a copy of the book. You know, some of the things that, and I've gone through the book, and the pointers that you give or the advice that you give, of course, you're a clinical professor of psychology, so you know what you're talking about, are some tips and some early warning signs of trouble. Let's go through a few of those.
Okay. If your children start expressing reluctance to spend time with you, they want to cancel the scheduled weekend they're supposed to be with you, for example, or they don't want to come back to your home after they've been with the other parent, you know, occasionally there's a good reason for that, but if you see a pattern developing, that's a red flag, and it's better not to let that go on too long. In some of these cases, children begin calling a parent by their first name.
Yeah.
And they do this usually under the influence of the other parent. So a dad says, you know, Jane's on the phone, do you want to speak to her? And the kids are sort of shocked that dad's referring to mom in that way, but pretty soon the kids get the idea that dad doesn't want them to think about her as mom anymore, and so they follow suit. So that's something that you've got to be concerned about. If the children start giving complaints that either sound like nothing a child would think of, like a young child saying that he feels violated by his dad's visits, another child who complains that you're trying to buy my love when he gets a trip to the toy store. One girl complained that her grandparents had too much money. It was a complaint she heard, you know, from a parent, and then just parrots that complaint and echoes it. So if you hear the children making the same complaints as your ex, or using language that's not at all childlike, that raises a concern that the child is being influenced in some way to develop and to think about you in a negative way. When you ask children about it, though, most often if they've already become alienated, if they're really rejecting the parent, they'll claim that they thought of all this on their own, no matter how ridiculous it seems. That's how it feels to them, because many times the children are just not aware of how they've been influenced. They've been taught to hate in very similar ways to the way children are taught to hate people of other races, or they develop prejudices against people with different religions. But in this case, it's a prejudice against a parent that they used to love. Things get worse, though, then when the child begins rejecting not just one parent, but people associated with that parent, aunts and uncles, grandparents, cousins. Anyone on that side of the family is considered the enemy, and the child basically wants to disown half the family. These are some of the more common signs that we see in children as they're becoming alienated. They become concerned about showing affection for one parent when the other parent's around, because they sense that, you know, that the favored parent doesn't want them to be enjoying time with the other parent. They may not want to take gifts that you give them back to their other house. They feel like it would be a reminder to the other parent of that they had a good time with you. And the kids have become sensitive that, you know, mom doesn't want to hear these things about it. She doesn't want to know we're enjoying our time with dad, or dad doesn't want to know we're enjoying our time with mom, because, you know, this works on both sides. There are mothers who do this to their kids, fathers who do it to their kids, and some unfortunate children get it both ways.
Yeah, and that's the sad part. Dr. Richard Warshak is here talking about the book Divorce Poison, and we've talked about the parents using their child as a pawn, and I want to get into more about the learned, I call it the learned behavior. They're parroting what their parents are saying, whether they understand the consequences of it or not. But I guess my next question is, Doc, is they're doing this now, they're being used by their parents because of the divorce, one against the other. How much of that learned behavior, what they're learning, will they take into their own relationship many years down the road, and what are the chances of them heading to divorce?
Well, we do know that children whose parents are divorced themselves have a higher rate of divorce when they grow up and get married. We're not sure exactly why that is, but I think one element may be this, because what happens in a case like this is the children begin having some conflict with a parent. Maybe they're reluctant to spend time with that parent, or that parent grounded them. And they go home and they complain. You know, they'd say, Daddy, Mom grounded us just because we came in late. Now a good parent's going to back up the other parent. But in this case, Dad may say, well, you know, if you come live with me, you could stay out as late as you want. And instead of working out the conflict with their mother, they learn to avoid her and avoid conflict. Now, if they grow up like that, then when they start having conflicts in their relationships, which of course are inevitable in any relationship, their impulse may be just to avoid it, just to run away, cut off the relationship, rather than work it through, manage this conflict, deal with it in a more mature manner, because they haven't seen their parents doing that.
You know, when you look at that, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you look at that, and what you say makes total sense to me. Let's go back to the Golden case for a minute. You get a high-profile case like this, and there's many of them. We just don't hear about them every day, but when you have an international incident, parental divorce and all this sort of stuff, but all of a sudden the news media gets involved and everybody else gets involved, and some of the best questions I heard in that case that were brought up, had anybody asked Sean what he thought? Everyone was asking one parent, the other parent, they said this, they said that. But how important is it to have someone neutral, actually, and I don't know if there is, and maybe that's a dumb term on my part, but having a third party sit down and actually ask the child what they think?
Well, you know, naturally, when you're making a decision that affects a child's future and the child's lifestyle, you know, you think, well, we certainly want to know what does the child think about it. But, you know, you've got to step back for a minute, because there's a real risk when you put a child in the position where the child's being interviewed and asked, you know, what do you think about this custody situation?
Mm-hmm.
What happens is it sets the child up to be manipulated by whichever parent has the most influence over the child and the least inhibition about using that influence to exploit the child, to try to lobby the child. It's like a political campaign, you know, where they try to lobby the child to take their side. So although I'm a big advocate for, you know, involving children in these decisions by trying to find out how they feel about it, it's very important to recognize that in these cases, sometimes it's very hard to really get at what the child's underlying feeling is. Sometimes they don't feel free to express it. And even if they do, sometimes the feeling has been so heavily influenced by a parent that it's not a reliable index of what's really best for the children. The children may say they want one kind of arrangement, and in the cases I deal with, very often they're saying, I don't want to see one parent. And they just want to disown that parent. And I think that when these kids grow up, they look back and they say, how could you have left such a life-altering decision to me? How could you have put me in that position? They feel guilty if they spoke out against the parent. They feel like they missed out on a lot, because if the court listens to them and lets them disown the parent, which unfortunately does happen,
mm-hmm.
These kids don't have dad sitting at the games during the graduation, or if they've sided with dad, their mom's not there for them to go look at colleges when it's time to look at colleges, not there for the prom night, things like this. They miss out on a lot of the interactions, and even if, as they grow up, if they've realize they made a mistake and reconcile, they can't make up for all those lost years.
It says here, Divorce Poison is a must read for every parent involved in a hostile divorce. and I'm going to hold it up again for our television audience and for those of you looking at the show webcam. We call it the monkey cam. But not only is it for someone going through parent involved in this in a hostile divorce, but the families, because there's that big picture. There may be a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or someone that's trying to, you know, they see that the child is being used or they're getting caught in the middle themselves. And I guess, Dr. Warshak, what is your advice for other family members that are sitting back and seeing this ugliness go on? Can they do anything to help?
The best thing they can do is to try to stay out of the fray, because very, very quickly, if they come, for example, if children are beginning to reject their mother, and then her parents take offense at that and try to defend her, the kids may just end up rejecting the grandparents.
Yep.
Because this hatred spreads, mm-hmm. and it spreads very quickly. So it's important for grandparents to try to stay neutral, and to try to maintain contact with these children, because the most important thing is not to lose that contact. So aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, try to stay involved. Try not to get drawn into discussions about which parent is right and which parent is wrong. And eventually you may be a bridge to help the child reconnect and rediscover the loving feelings for a parent that they've been rejecting. So you don't want to get involved in what some psychologists call this tribal warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most grandparents will react naturally by being horrified if they hear kids being rude and treating another parent with contempt. The problem, though, is it doesn't help any to chastise the kids, to, you know, yell at them, how dare you speak that way, because at this point the children feel they have permission to be disrespectful, and they've learned that they can get away with it because one of their parents basically is pleased with the kids being mean to the ex and even the ex's families. So it's better to try to have a thick skin about this. Don't make the mistake of rejecting the children and telling them, well, if you feel that way about us, then we never want to see you again. You'll come back when you feel better, when you feel different, then look us up. Because what happens is that day may never come. One of the things that people have told me is so helpful to them in the book is the test I offer for parents who feel they have to say something about the other parent that's negative, that the kids need help to understand some problem the other parent has. Maybe the parent's always late to pick them up or something like that.
Right.
And the question is, how can you do that in a way that's not going to harm the children? You know, for example, when you're married and your spouse has a problem that's affecting the children, like maybe being late and disappointing the children, you find some way to explain it to the kids so that they don't lose their respect for the parent, that they learn that, you know, we all make mistakes. It doesn't mean daddy doesn't love you if he's late. He's late with everyone. And you teach the children how to cope with that rather than just demonizing a parent because they've got some problems.
You know, many times when I've interviewed fathers in most cases, and a couple of mothers too, where they've been denied access, and that's my term, to their child, or their child refuses to see them, at least says they refuse to see them. How do you respond to that in your book, Doctor? How do you tell someone, or what's the advice that you give to someone how to react when your child says they won't see you?
Well, there's a lot of things to do, but one of the most important is to make sure you don't allow the contact to end because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Keep seeing your child as you work to understand the child's feelings. The children may have a legitimate gripe about you. They may just be showing how difficult it is for them to adjust to the divorce and to adjust to having two homes to go back and forth to. But if they're really being, if you're being deprived of contact with the children, you've got to do everything you can to reinstate the contact as soon as possible. And if it means getting legal help, you've got to get the legal help. You can tell the children, you can tell your ex that you want to work this out. You're willing to go to counseling to figure out, you know, what is going on in the family, and the entire family then needs to participate in that. But oftentimes, what's most important is just getting that contact. Give the kids a chance to see that you're not the bad parent that they may be hearing when they're in the other home. And so it's very important to do that. It's important to develop a thick skin because the kids are going to be saying some really mean things, and it doesn't help to lose your temper, because when you do, that just gives them more reason to want to avoid you. So you've got to, you know, you've got to hang in there, not give up. When these, especially when children are totally losing contact with you, you've got to continue to show them that you love them, reassure them that you are waiting for them, that when they come, you're not going to be rehashing the past, you're not going to be punishing them for having rejected you, you're just going to be glad that they're back.
The book is Divorce Poison, How to Protect Your Family from Bad-Mouthing and Brainwashing. Dr. Richard Warshak has been my guest for the first segment of the show. His webpage is www.warshak.com. That's WARSHAK.com. I'm giving away actually six copies of the book to the first six emailers. Dana Pretz, Dana at ScaredMonkeys.com. Dana at ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks, Doc. I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You know, I think it's an important book. It's a great resource. And, again, it's something, like it says here right on the book. And, again, I'll hold it up for those of you watching on Channel 7 and those of you on the dreaded Monkey Cam. By the way, you can go to the Monkey Cam by going to www.com/DanaPretzer1, the number one. So www.com/DanaPretzer1, not the number sign, DanaPretzer1. Okay. You'll figure it out. And six copies of this book go to the first six emailers. Where you're, whether you're listening live or you're picking us up on the podcast or you're watching on television on cable access channel 7. We're going to take a break. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer, and when we come back, syndicated radio host, crime reporter, author Mike McIntyre from MikeOnCrime.com. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. It's always a pleasure to have my next guest on, Robin Sachs, with her weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Dana Pretzer. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You're suffering with a cold a little bit, so we won't let you talk too much tonight. We don't want you to...
Oh, come on. I've got that sexy voice thing going.
Yeah. Well, okay. We'll save that for another show.
Okay.
Anyway, lots of breaking news tonight. One of our sister blogs, Blink on Crime, and others have broken the story about the possibility of Morgan Harrington being found. We'll touch on that briefly tonight and then follow up with a full show next week. Your thoughts on this case, a missing person. It's always great when we find them. It's always sad when we just find their remains.
Well, this case is particularly heartbreaking for me as I was actually had the honor of being on a show with Morgan's family back on Dr. Phil's show about 6 weeks ago. And I was impressed with their strength and fortitude in terms of looking for Morgan and was puzzled with the circumstances behind her disappearance. And it's just one of those, you know, horrific, worst case scenarios, most awful thing to think of, that at least when you're in the moments of talking to someone while their child is still missing, you can share in the hope that perhaps that they will be found alive.
Yeah.
So when you then reach this point where you find that there have been remains that have been found, you know that there's no longer hope, and the only thing you can do is feel that there may be a sense of closure and a chance to allow some healing to happen. And, you know, people who go through the situation, you know, are literally walking zombies. They, you know, sleep minimally. And there, many people don't realize, besides thinking about the parents, in this case, I believe Morgan has a brother or sister, definitely a sibling. And these are other children who have to live, you know, with their parents being basically absent as well and almost missing in their own way. And so besides the horrific circumstances that the parents have to go through, we seldom talk about the other siblings who have to sit and watch this as they not only have to cope with their own loss, but deal with then going back into society and feeling, you know, strong and not fearful, and then also deal with the ramifications and the loss that their parents must deal with. So I feel for the siblings as well as Morgan's parents, if in fact this turns out to be Morgan.
Yeah, right. And it is. It's so tragic. And what we will do, Robin, and for everyone listening, we will follow up, and we will certainly cover this next week on the show. And I encourage you to check out scaredmonkeys.com and blinkoncrime.com for all the breaking news in this case. Another case, Robin, you and I have covered and talked about many, many times, has finally begun. The Rebecca McEvoy rape trial is finally underway after many, many delays. Crawford versus Washington, all that stuff. Your thoughts on Becca McEvoy?
That's what I've heard. I heard that through the grapevine and through social networking sources, and really, I was really surprised how, I'm thrilled that the case is finally getting underway and there may be a chance at justice in this case, but the thing that's unbelievable to me, and it's kind of my theme of the day, you know, I find these themes of the days, of the bullying and the control that suspects and defendants think that they can have in the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here we were in a situation, and there was, you know, obviously we're very familiar with the Becca McEvoy's case, but really where the defense was calling the shots on when this case was going to be tried and played out, and the only person that can put a kibosh on that is the judge, and thankfully in this case it did happen. There are other cases that I'm aware of and involved in where I've become aware of information, and instead of dealing with the situation at hand, the defendants who are abusers feel that they can further bully, threaten not just the people and the parties involved in the case, but then the people who are wanting to bring awareness to the case. And I believe that's what happened with Becca McEvoy's case, was that this case kind of quietly began in trial because the McEvoy family was pretty much threatened that if they were to, you know, let anyone know that the trial was going to start and it got any sort of media publicity, that they were going to get in big trouble. I mean, this is an open courtroom, a public information, a right for us to know. And it's frightening that those bullying tactics actually work.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right, and it's a story we'll follow up on, and I know the family, they're good people, and let's see if the system is going to work for them. I certainly hope so. Nancy Grace, and the Duckett, the death of Melinda Duckett, and the lawsuit against Nancy Grace. I think Nancy Grace is still mad at me for having the Duckett family lawyer on the show, but there's breaking news tonight that Nancy Grace wants to avoid the television cameras, as strange as that sounds, at her deposition. Now, I don't know. I'm always one to look at information in the media. I believe in freedom of the press. I believe in covering stories the best we can, but I've always had this weird feeling about these videotaped depositions and them making it to the media. So I side with Nancy Grace on this one. I think the suit itself, if it goes to trial, will be important, especially with the media aspect to it and how you cover a story. But as far as releasing her deposition to the media, I don't think it should be. I think it should be blocked. Your thoughts?
I agree. I mean, first of all, there's a couple of things that I think. I mean, I generally think that the media does present its own issues in the courtroom, and this is where I wear my two hats, and I'll sound like a hypocrite, and I'm sure people will accuse me of that, and frankly, I am, and I'm happy to say that. It's different when it's your case versus somebody else's case, and that's kind of like one of those things that I'm happy for the courts to kind of make that decision for us, basically. Because if I'm a party or I'm a lawyer on a case, I think that the presence of the cameras changes how everybody acts, whether we want to admit it or not. Lawyers play up to the cameras or play down to the cameras. Judges play up or down to the cameras. It's the same kind of feeling when you have, you know, when you're being observed, if you're a teacher in a classroom and you have a principal watching you, it's the same thing if you're a kid and your parent is overseeing what you're doing. I mean, you do things differently, and sometimes it's not the fullest extent of justice, not to mention that I do believe in Nancy Grace's particular situation. We're pre-trial discovery phase deposition. So this isn't the regular course of where videotaping really occurs anyway. If it was a matter of course and it was some sort of special exception for Nancy Grace, then I would maybe feel a little bit different, but it's not. This is the early stages of discovery. This is pre-settlement potentially. And frankly, for her own well-being and safety, the
yep.
last thing that that interest of her protection, given the fact that she is a public figure, should be played out here. So I'm siding with Nancy 100%.
I agree totally. And it will be a case that will be decided on. It's going to be an interesting one, and I'm not sure if it'll set precedent, but it'll certainly. It won't bring Melinda Duckett back. It won't help find Trenton Duckett, but it will certainly question the ethics of some interviewers, and I'm not saying I side on either side. Robin, earlier on in the show tonight, and I talked about it in my commentary today, too, we were talking with a crime reporter about frivolous lawsuits. In fact, I happened to be listening to a talk show and hearing a story about a police officer who had stopped a vehicle for a traffic infraction. We call it an infraction up here in Canada. Anyway, and let the person go. And as he's sitting on the side of the road with his flashing lights going, he ends up having to get rear-ended by a drunk driver. Okay, the police officer is injured. The drunk driver is injured. The drunk driver is convicted of DUI. But since then, the police officer has been sued by the drunk driver and the drunk driver's wife. The drunk driver sued the police officer for leaving his flashing lights on, and he was distracted more by the flashing lights than the fact that he blew whatever on the intoxilizer. And the wife sued the police officer for mental anguish because of not being able to be with her husband for a while. And this poor cop, when I heard him interviewed, you got to wonder why, and I ask myself that quite often too, why we even go out there and do the job that we do when you have to put up with this kind of crap. And frivolous lawsuits are just that. They're a glut on the system, and I'm curious your thoughts, both as an attorney and someone who comments in the media. Why is this crap even allowed to go ahead?
Well, this is the one very frustrating thing with the legal system, and I explain this to people all the time, and it's frustrating. I mean, there is very little that stops crazy people from misusing the justice system. Anybody can go file a lawsuit whenever they want. It's then what happens, and so it's so frustrating. What people don't recognize is that even a baseless lawsuit is one that usually needs to be defended against. And I personally believe that there should be more actions for malicious prosecution and bringing forth unfounded malicious lawsuits for no reason, because the overly litigious people not only are making a mockery of themselves, causing anguish to the parties that are involved, but costing us as taxpayers tons of dollars and wasted time and wasted resources in courtrooms that need justice. I mean, here we're taking furlough days, and courts are taking furlough days, and then you have this crap that, clogs up our system, and it's ridiculous. But you know what? It's kind of part and parcel of what goes on kind of every other aspect of the world. I mean, there's nutballs out there, and until we start dealing with the nutballs in some other way, and it's, I don't know, there's no crime of being a jerk out there yet, but I certainly wish there was.
Well, and you're right, and we all hope that these cases get tossed out, but sadly, insurance companies will settle because they don't want to spend the cost and go to trial. Sometimes people will settle because they don't want to spend the cost and go to trial, but, neither here nor there. I can remember many, many, many years ago when police cars actually had two flashing lights on the roof, one bubble on each side, and yours truly was at a scene, and I had my lights going, and I had to deal with a civilian complaint because the person who wanted to watch the scene was distracted by my flashing lights, and I actually had to answer to that, and it was unbelievably, certainly frustrating. Robin Sachs is here, and her website is robinsachs.com. Justice Interrupted Radio has returned. You can click on the link at robinsachs.com or go to justiceinterrupted.com. What's next for you besides coming back here a week from today?
You know, I don't even know what is on my calendar right now. That's how crazy I've been. I know it's a busy, crazy week. Sunday is our new time for Justice Interrupted, which is at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we've had an exciting lineup of guests. We don't know who our guests are quite yet because we're not nearly as organized as you are. We're just getting back in the swing of things, but we have been much appreciating your humor and producer notes that you send to us on a regular basis, and that is what I definitely know. Oh, and also there's a book signing that I'm doing with Mark Garagos at Village Books in Pacific Palisades, and we have an unbelievable turnout. I think we have some 50 people who have already RSVP'd yes for it, so clearly everyone wants to see Mark, and I'm really excited to share the stage with him.
Well, they're not just wanting to see him. They're wanting to see you, too. Robin Sachs, her weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. Thank you, ma'am. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. And remember, we will give away 6 copies of the book Divorce Poison by Dr. Richard Warshak. He was the first guest on tonight's program. And click on the link in the show notes to check out his website. Or if you want a free copy, and I've got 6 of them to give away, not just to live listeners, but to, I don't mean a live listeners, but to those that listen live or to those who listen on the podcast or watch on TV or pick us up on satellite or low power FM, wherever you hear the show. You can certainly email me at dana@scaredmonkeys.com, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, and the first 6 emailers will get a free copy of the book. That's it. That's tonight's show. Next week, we plan to follow up on the Morgan Harrington case, Becca McAvoy, and many others. So stay tuned. Check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com for our daily commentaries, live shows, and podcasts of past shows. We'll see you again real soon. Good night.
Listening to the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.